Welcome to the March monthly policy update. I'm Brenna Stroop with Independent Sector. Today we'll be joined by my IS colleagues Jeff Moore, Becca Busick, and Allison Grayson, as well as Nick Giordano with Washington Council Ernst & Young. Before we get into today's agenda, I want to go over a few housekeeping details. As part of our conference call feature, all the lines are currently muted and we will pause periodically for questions from you guys. If you have any questions, you can unmute your line by pressing *6, and we ask that you mute again when you're done. If you have any technical difficulties, please send me an email at brennas@independentsector.org. We look forward to your questions today, and we really appreciate your attendance, and I will turn it over to Jeff Moore now.
Thanks, Brenna, and welcome everybody. Good afternoon. I don't know how many of you are sitting in Washington on your phone, but it does appear that spring has finally arrived. I know you're used to hearing the dulcet tones of Jamie Tucker. It would not be quite the pleasant listening experience at the moment. He is down with strep throat, and so we wanted to give him the time off to recuperate. So happy to fill in for him. It is a very full agenda. The way we typically kick off, as we will today, is to turn to our Washington Council Ernst & Young colleagues and Nick Giordano specifically to give us kind of a lay of the land. And we've asked Nick to talk on several different topics. He'll tick through them. We'll take some time for questions, discussion, and then dig deeper into a couple of additional items on the agenda as you see it. The one thing I do want to forecast is that we are going to use some time toward the end of the agenda to get some very specific feedback from you. We are preparing to take a perspective, gather a perspective, take a perspective on a legislative opportunity into Senator Stabenow's office. I will talk more about this in a moment, but we are going to look for some very specific feedback from you, so please hang with us through the whole of the agenda if you can. With that, Nick, let me turn it over to you. There's been a lot going on. Hoping that you can just give us kind of a high flyover, anything in particular that is standing out, either good, bad, predictive of what is to come.
All right, I'll attempt to do that, Jeff. Can you hear me okay? I'm sorry to have to be on the phone and not in the room there with you. Yeah, let me just run through several items that we talked about going over and then see if there's any questions or follow-up. I guess first, with Congress in recess for this week and next week, prior to heading out of town, as I think probably everybody knows, they did get final agreement, and after some grumbling from the president, he did sign the omnibus spending bill, omnibus appropriations bill for FY18. And so this was a bill that filled in the details of the caps on spending that had been agreed to in a prior continuing resolution. And this incorporated basically all of the appropriations bills for the year in one omnibus package. And this goes through September 30, 2018. So we'll have to do this all over again in some form as we get toward the end of September. And that could be, you know, another continuing resolution to fund the government in a short term to get through the election, or other types of additional appropriations legislation for FY19, which starts on October 1st. In this bill, I think just a couple things to point out. In addition to the spending items that reflected the caps that I mentioned, there were a series of tax provisions that were included. However, most of it dealt with legislation that had been passed previously. So legislation other than the big tax bill passed in 2017, there were a series of technical corrections that had been building up over the years that they incorporated into this bill, about 170 pages or so of legislative text. And nothing that's consequential that we spotted anyway for the sector. But importantly, there were only really two changes to the 2017 bill that were included. One was to fix a problem that had been identified in the agriculture industry that dealt with the small business deduction for flow-through entities. And in exchange for that, in order to get Democrats to agree, the Democrats insisted that there be some plus up in the low-income housing tax credit. And so, interestingly enough, it was kind of an odd trade-off. The provision to fix the agriculture provision actually raised $108 million over a 10-year period, and the low-income housing enhancements lose almost $2.8 billion over a 10-year period. So the Democrats drove a pretty hard bargain. There were no other changes to the 2017 bill that were included in this omnibus appropriations bill. And we can talk in a minute about what that might portend for later in the year, because there is at least one correction that I think pertains to the sector that I do want to point out. Importantly for the sector, the Johnson Amendment was not touched in this legislation. There had been some talk that maybe it was on a list of things that Republicans were looking to include in the bill. But we had pretty good discussions. IS had good discussions with both the House and Senate leadership and others. And at the end of the day, we understand that Democrats pretty universally weighed in opposition of touching the Johnson Amendment. And we understand that the Senate side in particular, with on the Republican side, also agreed, Senator Hatch from the Finance Committee and the leadership opting not to try to push to include repeal of the Johnson Amendment in the omnibus bill. So that's kind of a summary of the omnibus. I don't know, Jeff, maybe I'll pause for a second, because I do want to talk about what it looks like for the rest of the year, the possibility of another tax bill and some of the things hinging off of this legislation. But let me just pause to see if you guys want to add anything or if there's any questions from the group on the phone.
Yeah, let's pause for questions or comments. Very important to come back to that second piece, Nick, that you suggested around the possibility of additional tax legislation.
Right.
But let's take a moment. Any questions around the omnibus, where we landed? Okay, Nick, why don't you, Allison, go ahead.
Sure. I mean, I just want to highlight, although, I mean, we have a podcast that came out this week that goes a little more in depth, but just really quickly, for those of you on the call, there's a couple of sort of specific things to call out related to the omnibus. That are worth noting for the sector. One is a lot of the programs that were slated to be eliminated were preserved, which Nick mentioned, but just specifically the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities, the Corporation for Community Service, which is what houses the AmeriCorps program, which provides staffing to a lot of nonprofits, was preserved. Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Census 2020, which we've done podcasts about why it's so important to not just sort of fully fund from a historic standpoint the census, but actually increase funding for the census. The census did receive an increase in funding, which there were advocates concerned that that wouldn't happen. But I want to flag that a lot of advocates believe this amount still is not sufficient to get an accurate count in Census 2020, and so they're going to probably circle back and encourage the sector to do more advocacy to increase funding in future bills, because there's a very real concern that an undercount on the census will have some pretty dire consequences for how nonprofits do their work. And then I know independent sector, we opposed the tax bill in 2017, and one of the many reasons we were concerned about it was the negative impact it was going to have on vulnerable people from a healthcare perspective, because it repealed the individual mandate, so it meant about 13 million people would no longer have healthcare. In that debate, there was a hope that there would be some kind of legislative fix to happen in the new year that could help provide coverage for those people. Senator Collins was one of the people central to that conversation, and there was a hope that that fix could be a part of the omnibus bill. It was not. So it's just a couple of things that we've talked about in the past to flag as content, yep. And then obviously we have other resources with more detail as needed.
Great. Thanks, Allison. Nick, let me turn back to you if you want to talk about kind of the go forward.
Yeah, sure, Jeff. I guess you know, if you look at Congress for the rest of the year, given this omnibus bill, you know, there's not a lot of must-do legislation as we've seen in years past when there are lots of deadlines and things. Coming out of the omnibus, the one thing that clearly is going to have to be dealt with again before the end of the year. Well, a couple of things. One, just there's going to have to be additional funding beyond September 30th. That's a given. But also the omnibus bill extended the authorization and funding of the Federal Aviation Administration through September 30th. So there's going to have to either be additional, you know, continuing legislation for that or possibly a separate FAA bill. And the reason I mention that is that the FAA legislation is a revenue bill by definition because of the excise taxes that are involved. So that could provide an opportunity for Congress to do some additional tax legislation. And one thing that we've uncovered for the sector, and I think has been written about a little bit in some of the tax press anyway, and has been the subject of some correspondence with Treasury, is that there is a need for a technical correction to fix the provision in the tax bill that increased the limitation from 50% to 60% of adjusted gross income for cash contributions. Apparently, the way the legislation got drafted, it inadvertently does not actually provide the 60% limit, particularly in a case where a taxpayer has both cash and non-cash contributions. So there's some recommendations to fix this to make sure it works right. That'll have to be done in a separate bill at some point, and maybe the FAA could provide an opportunity to do that and maybe some other things, but it's going to require bipartisan support, as none of this is going to be conducted under a reconciliation process. There's a lot of rumors that you've read and heard about the idea of doing a phase two tax bill, I think the president and Chairman Brady and others are calling it, where they might go ahead and try to make the individual provisions that currently are due to expire after 2025, try to make them permanent and perhaps do some additional things on the tax side. I think that most people on the Hill, when you talk to them about it, about the reality of this, is sure, we could have a proposal and we could see some legislation, but it's not going to make its way through the process. It's not going to become a law in 2017. It's more of a political exercise for the midterm elections. You know, elect, keep the Republicans in power. Here's what you get. If you don't, then, you know, you're not going to get additional tax legislation that's beneficial. Perhaps you might get bad legislation. That'll be the political talking points from the Republican side for that. So you could see a lot of activity and discussion about this. They might even draft a bill, but we're not going to have a reconciliation process. So unless a lot of Democrats in the Senate decide that they're going to support something like that, you're not going to see that move forward. Another thing we'll see, as we typically do in conjunction with April 15th and the individual tax filing deadline, the House Ways and Means Committee is looking at doing a markup of an IRS reform bill. They're calling it the Taxpayer First legislation. A draft of it was issued, discussion draft was issued on Monday of this week by Lynn Jenkins, Republican from Kansas, and it's a bipartisan bill with John Lewis, a Democrat from Georgia, both of them being the chair and ranking member of the Subcommittee on Oversight. A lot of things in here that change some of the things in terms of the Internal Revenue Service, creating an independent Office of Appeals, requiring a customer service strategy, things of this nature. There's lots of changes are in here. The one thing that is directed to the sector and is very pertinent is that we see again a proposal for mandatory electronic filing for all annual returns of exempt organizations, regardless of size. Although there is a two-year delay proposed for what they call small organizations, they define that to be if you have gross receipts of less than $200,000 and gross assets of less than $500,000. It's quite possible you could see a full committee markup on this legislation, perhaps the week of April 9th. At this point, there is no thought of a companion bill in the Senate. We were being told by Senate Finance Committee staff that they are looking at doing a hearing on the tax filing season on April 12th. I don't know that that's been officially noticed yet, but that's what they're looking at. And at this point, there does not appear to be a desire to do a companion IRS tax reform bill or in the Senate, but that could change over time. And Jeff, there's other things in that legislation that people in the sector may be interested in, but they don't, as I can tell anyway, don't have a direct effect on the members. They do try to make some changes directed at making filing and some other things easier for lower income taxpayers, but I don't see anything else that deals specifically with 990s and things of that nature. We've gone through the bill, the drafts, in pretty detailed manner, but there could be changes as the committee members, when they come back from recess, begin to put it together for a markup. I guess the only other thing I would mention before turning it back to you is that there continues to be, well, two things I'll mention. One, on the legislative side, and I know you're going to get into this, Jeff, just what you referred to, we continue to have folks on the Hill interested in charitable giving legislation or legislation that affects the sector. We know that Senator Thune and his staff continue to be interested in the pieces of their charitable legislation that did not get enacted as part of the 2017 legislation. We know that Senator Stabenow and her staff are interested possibly in looking again at some freestanding legislation to be supplement or additive to the current law with regard to charitable giving, and I know you'll get into that. And final point is on the regulatory side, lots of discussion from attorneys from the Office of Tax Policy in public panels and forums about the their work on guidance with respect to two provisions of note. One, the unrelated business income tax change in the tax bill that requires kind of a segmenting of business activities and kind of separating those within an organization and some filings with respect to each of the activities separately. And then this whole issue that I know many in the sector are concerned about is the designation of certain benefits that are paid by tax-exempt organizations and treating them as unrelated business income tax. And several of the attorneys from the Office of Tax Policy have said they're interested in hearing from folks on that, and they're in the midst of doing their work and trying to get toward a point where they're going to be able to promulgate guidance in that area. So I'll stop, Jeff, turn it back to you.
Thank you, Nick. Before I pause and turn to the group for questions, Brenna, specifically just wanted to follow up with you. I know that in the visits that you have been making kind of systematically on the Hill, you've been hearing a fair amount about both Jenkins Lewis and some of these rumors that Nick was talking about around additional kind of phase two tax legislation focusing in on individuals. Anything more that you would want to add?
Yeah, the one other thing I would add on the Jenkins Lewis bill is that there's a program that's called the Volunteer Income Tax Assistant Program, VITA, that will gain more secure funding under this bill. So right now it's a free tax return filing assistance program that offers services to low-income populations, people with disabilities, and taxpayers with limited English proficiency, as well as just underserved communities in general. And currently the law is that the IRS grants matching or gives matching grants to the organizations that work on this. However, the bill will provide permanent matching grants now to organizations, or it will if it's passed. So that's something that could affect the sector a decent amount.
Yeah. And anything more beyond what Nick had shared around a phase two tax? I mean, what you're hearing, I think, is pretty consistent with what
we just expect it to be a pretty partisan situation.
Great. Okay, let me pause and see any questions on the phone for Nick or Allison, Brenna, me, anybody, thoughts, questions, something not clear? Okay, I'm going to ask you to continue to think. And while you do that, I want to turn to Allison and ask her to take us into a little bit deeper dive where we are on Johnson Amendment specifically. And then I know we want to talk about public student loan forgiveness because there was a real victory there in the context of the omnibus. And so if you want to address both of those, and then we'll take another pause, see if there are questions, accumulated questions.
Sure, I'm glad to. And actually, before I launch into those, I'll just give a personal plug for the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program. I've been a VITA volunteer for over a decade. And not only is it a really rewarding program, but it actually is one of the primary vehicles to enable people to claim the earned income tax credit, which is one of the more successful and bipartisan policies. It helps low-income individuals through the tax code. So that's why this is, it seems like a very small thing to help with these matching grants, but it actually can have a pretty significant impact at the local level. So I did not know that that was in the bill, Brenna. That's really exciting. And as a volunteer, I'm jazzed to see more organizations be able to provide this opportunity in their community. So, Johnson Amendment.
Yep.
We just came from a coalition meeting, sort of assessing where we are on the Johnson Amendment. We had a pretty great victory on that topic.
We did.
In the omnibus bill, we know in the final hours of negotiation, technically the Johnson Amendment was on the table as something that could be included at the last minute. So, and sort of a diverse collection of coalitions made sure that they were sending really fairly regular messages to policymakers, both their local policymakers as well as leadership within Congress who might be making these last minute deals in negotiations, that adding a provision that would repeal or weaken the Johnson Amendment was so politically fraught, it wouldn't be worth adding into this kind of bill if they really wanted it to pass. And that message seemed to have been heard by policymakers, I think, particularly on the Senate side. And so it was a success for advocacy on behalf of the sector. I think there was also, Brenna, I'd be interested in your read of this, but there seems to be some traction that the sector is also gaining. Again, a little more, I think, I perceive on the Senate side than on the House side. But of people who also just agree that this is not a great policy proposal. There was sort of a lack of education when we first started doing these meetings as to exactly what the impact would be. But as we go into these meetings now, a lot of people, both Democrats and Republicans, seem to acknowledge, wow, there are a lot of concerns and questions that are coming up. We had a meeting with the Ways and Means Committee staff, different staff than we met with during tax reform, talk about Johnson Amendment and other issues. And there was some acknowledgement that questions were raised during the tax process about how, even for people who wanted to see a repeal or a weakening, they acknowledged things like a lack of definition of the term de minimis was problematic, even for advocates of that. So I think the awareness on the Hill seems to be increasing, which only further strengthens our ability to sort of mobilize in the future around this issue. But the one thing that I think is a big takeaway is sort of the Johnson Amendment made it further than anyone thought it would during tax reform. It made it further than anyone thought it would during the omnibus process. I mean, Brenna, we went to a lot of meetings the first part of this year. Did anybody in those meetings think that this was like a real thing that could happen in the final hours?
I think almost every office told us it was something we didn't need to worry about. And then we kind of proved them wrong, which is
yet
unfortunate. The one thing I've heard a lot over the last couple of months in talking to offices about it is that they said that they heard a lot pre-tax reform, the pre-tax reform bill, and they didn't hear from their constituents, organizations, before the omnibus bill. So it's something that we have to keep the momentum going for sure.
And so Britt, for that, before we sort of launch into what we should expect in the future, I think it's worth flagging. You sent out a call to action to some key states to thank leaders around the Johnson Amendment as a way of post a bill passage, thanking them for not including it in the bill. I know that I'm putting you on the spot a little bit, but do you remember off the top of your head which states those were?
I think there was Oregon, California, I'm trying to remember what else. Those are the ones I can remember.
Oregon and California.
Mostly because I'm
West. If you guys are interested, we're glad to send you a list and let you know where they were. And it was in particular, I know Georgia was one because we know Congressman Lewis played a role.
New York
was one.
Utah. Yeah. And so it was just people that we know made a particular effort to fend off any proposals to weaken the Johnson Amendment. So what's next? I think people are taking a moment to breathe on this issue, but there's an acknowledgement that, as I was saying before, because it made it as far as it did in the omnibus process, there is a recognition that the same people are probably encouraged to try again, possibly as soon as a CR conversation in September or whenever Congress decides to address funding for fiscal year 2019. And it probably will continue to come up for the next couple of years. So this is an issue that isn't going away. We're going to have to be vigilant and sort of be on the lookout for opportunities where people might want to try to slip it into a larger must-pass bill and make sure that we're continuing to do our work to educate policymakers to help them more fully understand why there are consequences in this. Because although I think, Brenna, when I say there have been advances made on people's awareness of the issue, it went from like 0 to 10. Like, we're not at 100. Like, there's still a lot more work we need to do. As I said, you know, the House side, there's a lot of work to do over there. So in most of what we've heard is what makes the biggest difference is hearing from people in their communities. So I think that's an opportunity for the sector to do great work in more educating and mobilizing within districts. I think at this point, Brenna, unless you have anything else to add, we might pivot over to the public service loan forgiveness.
Before we do that, let's just take a pause and see if there are any questions, reactions. Again, I mean, I think you hear from Allison and the whole of the IS team that this is a fight that is far from over. Nick will recall, of course, the conversation we had just now, what, 2 weeks ago, Nick, we were in with Congressman Richie Neal. You know, he made very clear that on the House side, among a certain core group of Republicans, true believers, that this is, you know, this is something that they will not give away easily. They will not go lightly. And that he continues to be kind of on the pointy end of the spear, watching from his particular position in House Ways and Means, but that, you know, we can't give up the vigilance because when we least expect it, it will come back.
Right. So, yeah, Jeff, I think that's right. And Senator Schumer's office was similarly, I think, very forward-leaning in telling us they would do everything they could to protect the Johnson Amendment.
Yep. So any questions for Brenna, Nick, Allison, reactions specific to Johnson Amendment? I mean, I think one of the lessons we're learning, right, is that as we continue, especially on the House side, Allison, you and I were talking about this earlier this morning, you know, is there some new approach to the way we message around Johnson Amendment, for instance, that we have to be thinking about to try and crack open into some of these spaces that have been so particularly hard? So lots of things that we're thinking about for the months and perhaps years ahead.
Jeff, I've got a question for you.
Great.
Can you hear me?
Yep, I sure can.
So, and this wasn't about the Johnson Amendment. This was about some prior remarks you made about the possibility that Senator Stabenow's office might be thinking about trying to introduce some additional measures that might be of interest to the sector. Were you talking specifically about reintroduction of a universal charitable deduction?
Quite possibly, and that's the next item on the agenda. So yes, we're going to step into this in greater detail.
Okay, thanks.
Absolutely. Any other questions about Johnson Amendment? If not, Allison, do you want to cover the public student loan forgiveness?
Sure, and I'll be quick so we can get into the charitable giving discussion that we're hoping to have. Just want to flag for everybody on the call, because we haven't talked about this a lot in this context, but public service loan forgiveness is something that we have been following as a issue for a little while. It is a federal program that's been around for, this year would be 11 years. So it's just actually beginning to kick in and be implemented. And it's really a program that provides the opportunity for people who are in public service professions, which includes either government employees at the local, state, or federal level, or people who work for charitable organizations to apply after 10 years of payment on their student loans to have their student loan liability forgiven because of their dedication to public service. So, as I said, people were just in this last year beginning to become eligible to actually have their loans forgiven. And just around the same time, there's some policymakers who started questioning whether or not this is a program that should continue. There is a perception among these people that this is a program that really is just a vehicle to allow doctors and lawyers to forgive their loans, and these are professions that should be capable of repaying their loans. But as a group that really looks at how to build a talented, first-rate workforce for the nonprofit sector, we see that this is an excellent program that helps us be more competitive in recruiting top talent into our field, retain that talent, so we prevent high turnover among staff, we prevent or we get to benefit from gaining institutional knowledge, and it provides some professional development opportunities for our employees who, after working in the sector for a while, may choose to go to graduate school to gain additional knowledge and skill sets and return to the sector knowing that they can still afford to have a baseline quality of life that allows them to start a family or buy a home or save for retirement, because they don't have to worry about trading those things off to pay off their student loans. So the reason this is an issue is because, like I said, there's some people who are just questioning the validity of the program, but specifically there have been efforts, including the last two president budgets, that have proposed to eliminate it. So there's a victory in the omnibus bill that the program was preserved, and actually it received a increase of $35 million that's going to be used to raise awareness among public service professionals to let them know how they can take advantage of the program. And also even included some things that actually corrected and improved the program, which I think people who are advocating to defend it would have been happy just if it was retained at all. So the fact that the bill included improvements to the program that have been long needed is a great signal to where this could be going. But there's also an acknowledgement that the arguments against the program aren't going away, and it's probably going to require kind of a continual battle by the public service sector to educate policymakers on why this is necessary, why it's a critically valuable investment, not just because it helps us get a great workforce, but by having a workforce that is not sort of limited to those people who could quote unquote afford to work in it. So that means folks who are coming into their education and didn't have to borrow quite as much, or they might have significant others who could help with their household income and offset some of the debt that they have, but actually allow us to recruit people from the communities that nonprofits serve. Ultimately, that means we have a more equitable and inclusive workforce. It improves the actual programs we create, and it gives us better outcomes, better impact by according to our mission, and it actually ends up saving government money in the future. So it's a win-win all around. We just have to make sure we continue to educate policymakers that is a fact. If people are interested, Infinite Sector did some lobbying on the Hill on this issue in the last couple months as a part of a coalition. And if you're interested in joining, feel free to go to their website. It's called Preserve, PSLF, which stands for the Public Service Loan Forgiveness. Again, preservepsls.com. And that will take you to the coalition's website. You can sign on to letters to Congress. You can join their Action Center. But also, if you have any questions, we'd be glad to link you up with the coalition as well. Thanks, Jeff.
Great. Thanks, Allison. Okay, we are going to pivot now, come back to the opportunity, quite frankly, that is before us, based on conversations we have been having with Senator Stabenow's office. I am going to urge you to be ready to take your phones off mute so that you can participate in this piece of the conversation. Let me give you a little bit of a setup. Obviously, we know that through the course of tax reform, we had two pieces of legislation, one in the House, one in the Senate, the Walker bill in the House, Lankford bill in the Senate, that introduced the concept of a universal charitable deduction. We were then, and we remain pleased that those were out in the space. They were not legislative vehicles, proposals that independent sector endorsed. There were a variety of reasons for that, including some concern around what caps could mean for giving. But those pieces of legislation continue to be out in the universe, if you will. And others are, including Senator Stabenow, thinking about how now that we're in a post-tax reform world, how we might need to come back with some legislative proposals to actually address some of the consequences of reform as it has been passed. So in particular, there's a conversation that we had with Sarah Shive in Senator Stabenow's office and a working group, a small working group of the Charitable Giving Coalition, which IS has been asked to help facilitate. And this conversation took place last week, where Sarah said, look, a couple of things. The senator is interested in introducing something relatively soon, i.e. some point this year, that begins to address some of the lingering concerns around how charitable giving in particular fared as a result of tax reform. And Nick mentioned this earlier, that the approach that she is looking to take would be additive to current law. This is not about striking down what is passed, but trying to build upon and correct. And she's very clear that she's looking for something that a broad segment of the sector can get behind, enthusiastically, and what legislator wouldn't want that, correct? So the challenge that she has given us, the opportunity really that she has given us, and IS specifically on behalf of the larger sector, is to start collecting some thoughts, some input, to help her think in terms of the guardrails, if you will, as to what that legislative approach might look like. And I think, if I walked away with anything from that conversation a little over a week ago with Sarah, is that their minds are really quite open. They are in listening mode right now. But they are also wanting to get to something fairly specific, fairly soon. And so they're turning to us to help them gather that input. So that in mind, we ran a bit of an exercise yesterday when we had the DC Advocates group here in our conference room, and we'll be running another conversation with the Charitable Giving Coalition Working Group, I think, next week. We're trying to take the temperature of the participants in these various conversations around where they would land. What are our go, no-go kind of considerations when we think about what it is that Senator Stabenow might introduce? So to get a little bit more specific, we know, as I mentioned, that the legislation that is out in the world, the Lankford and the Walker bills, have caps in the legislation, not floors. What is our thinking about caps versus floors as a community? are there, you know, kind of no-go considerations around that particular approach? Caps, good thing, bad thing, could never support something that included caps, floors, could be open to a conversation around floors, or no, could never go in the direction of a piece of legislation that had floors built in. I'll give you that there are sort of three or four markers that we're looking at, and then we'll open up for conversation, your feedback. So I've talked about caps and floors as a mechanism toward addressing cost, which is something that Sarah has also said. They are, you know, they're living in a world of cost constraints. They want to be mindful of that, but how they address cost and to what degree is something they're still trying to get their heads around. Then in terms of structure of the benefit, if you will, above the line deduction or a credit. Next category, very broadly around substantiation. What are we thinking when we start to talk about substantiation? How is that landing in the sector? And then the final, and we have heard this loud and clear from perhaps even some of you on the call today, you know, bipartisan approach, obviously, you know, always best. But for some organizations in the sector, they've made very clear to us that they cannot get behind a piece of legislation that isn't bipartisan in nature from the outset. So four categories before I open up the lines, Allison, Brenna, Becca, anything that you would add to further refine kind of these choices. And again, this is all very high level, notional. What we're trying to get from the group is, look, you know, what is your gut level sense? Could never get behind a cap. Well, I'm open to talking about a cap, but I know that it absolutely has to be a bipartisan piece of legislation. That is a go, no go kind of issue for me and for my organization. Allison, anything that you would add before we?
I think the only thing I would add is just to clarify a little bit what we mean by substantiation. Mm-hmm. Is we've heard in different conversations on the Hill questions and concerns about, okay, well, if you open up new charitable giving incentives to a broader cross-section of taxpayers, how do you make sure that they are, what they're claiming on their tax return is accurate and truly reflected what they gave to charity? And sort of right now, the sector's position has been, well, and in current law, is it's the taxpayer's responsibility to obtain the documentation they need to prove they gave the gift. And then it's the IRS's responsibility, you know, to go through and verify that taxpayers, you know, tax returns are accurate.
Right.
And if they do that through an audit, they ask the taxpayer to provide documentation of the charitable giving that they claimed on their tax return. And there seems to be some pushback from the Hill of acknowledging that that system may not be sufficient.
Enough. Yeah.
For a broad cross-section of taxpayers. And so what ideas can we bring to the table to help prove that that's accurate, or just basically to fend off any kind of abuse?
Right. So the question at hand is how prescriptive, in a sense, you know, legislation could be, should be around substantiation. Where does that start to create a vibration in the sector that would say, that's too much, that is hard, that's a hard place to go.
And I think there's some policymakers where they'd like to go is to put the burden on nonprofits to collect that information and to prove it. But we know that that raises some questions as well, which is why this is in the mix of wanting feedback.
So again, you've heard from us that the idea here is actually that we can hear from you as we continue to gather some feedback. to take back to Senator Savinow's office. So let's just open up the conversation, and let's start with this question of caps and floors. Anybody want to share a particular perspective? We could go one place, could never go the other, or I can't go in either direction, or I'm open, we're open to talking about either approach.
Wouldn't this be a good opportunity to have the same kind of research we got out of Indiana University that was projecting some numbers about doubling the charitable deduction? Could they not come up with some projections about what certain caps or certain floors would likely result in terms of the effect on charitable giving?
Allison, you want to speak to that?
Sure. I mean, there is some research that already exists, which we can rely upon to make some of these decisions. We know that some organizations, it doesn't really matter what the research says. Like for just sort of optics and principled reasons, they can't take a position on a cap, or they can't do it for a floor, which is why we're still having this conversation. But we're also trying to explore with the Urban Institute sort of creating a tax model based on the new tax system, and using that to run a couple of these proposals through that model, so we really can get a clearer picture of exactly how much giving is generated and for which parts of the taxpayer population, for which subsectors within the nonprofit sector, so we could just get a clearer picture as sort of more clearly defined proposals start emerging.
And the question is whether or not we can, you know, do that quickly enough. But no, the point is well taken. Other thoughts on caps and floors specifically? Again, this is our opportunity, so I'm encouraging you to think on this. And if you can't, you know, offer thoughts now that you feel sufficiently well formed, we'll make sure to provide opportunity for you to do that soon, so that we get as much feedback as we can. So, what about credit versus deduction? I was struck in the conversation with Sarah that I heard her talk an awful lot about credit, you know, as a construct as opposed to an above-the-line deduction. Allison, I see you shaking your head. It seems like you walked away with the same impression. She's obviously not made decision, but it sounds like there may be a leaning. So what do you all think about credit versus deduction?
I mean, both would serve as a giving incentive. Mm-hmm. In terms of the way we would be talking to our donors and potential donors.
Mm-hmm. Other thoughts?
Hello, this is Nick DeChakewski from the Mott Foundation. Can you hear me?
Hey, Nick. Yep, we can hear you.
Well, just a little background on where that may be coming from, because you are talking to Senator Stabenow's office. And in Michigan, we had a tax credit for 10 years on donations made to food banks, public radio, and community foundation endowments. And there may be one other class that I'm missing. But in any case, a few years ago, that tax credit was rescinded. And so we have had some data that shows that people were giving less as a result. And it was $200 for an individual and $400 for a married couple. But the important thing is it also showed that it was an important vehicle for younger people to get used to giving, because it would help stimulate that. So that is another angle that I know Rob Collier and the Council of Michigan Foundations have been highlighting, and they talk to regularly to Senator Stabenow and her staff. Yeah. So that could be where that interest in credit may be coming from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Nick. Other thoughts on this question of credit? Yeah, go ahead.
There's also a bill currently in the Michigan Senate to kind of restore those tax credits. That's a Republican sponsor for that legislation.
Anything else on this question?
Yeah, this is David Streeter with Washington Nonprofit. My question
David.
About, you know, the use of the term, you know, deduction or credit, you know, what would potential donors think about that? I mean, has there been any messaging about whether or any research into whether or not they would be responsive to, you know, getting a tax credit instead of a deduction, especially since, you know, the past practice has been to highlight tax deductibility. Are donors ready for that kind of a switch in the vocabulary?
I don't know, Allison, is there any research?
So there, not particularly on the vocabulary,
yeah.
But on the mechanism, there has been some research, and generally there's a deduction, like basically what they found is donors tend to give more when they have access to a deduction versus a credit, in part because of sort of how those two vehicles function within the tax code more than the language. The credit, you know, you tends to have sort of a value up to a certain limit and then it's done. Whereas a deduction doesn't have the same kinds of limitations typically. But I will say, and I think this is at least in part probably some Senator Stabenow's interest, is there's a worry that deductions, because they're sort of the value of the deduction is tied to your tax rate. There's a belief that higher income households that have higher tax rates actually benefit more from the deduction than lower income households, whereas credits, it's sort of a flat value that's applied across the board to all taxpayers, so it seems more fair. So there's, in some circles, there's a perception that credit is more progressive, a small p tax code progressive, than a deduction, but the deduction actually generates more giving.
More giving, yep. Okay, what about the substantiation issue and this question of, you know, the degree of prescriptiveness? What's the sense of the group on the phone? How does that land with you?
I didn't understand the argument for claiming that the current rules regarding substantiation would not be sufficient if you just expanded the universe of donors who are going to have certain deductibility opportunities.
Well, and Allison, you know, maybe wants to comment to this. I'm not sure that we would say that there is definitive argument. It's, some of this, I think, is in the eye of those that are kind of doing the looking, based on, you know, some sense that it's not sufficiently prescriptive, that we're, so, I don't know, Allison, anything that you would add? I mean, this, I agree that this one is perhaps the hardest of the four that we're talking about today, but anything more you would
so,
add?
So, I mean, I think the argument, I think, is probably coming from two directions. One, which I'm going to try to frame as sort of the more legitimate concern, which is there's an assumption that the IRS just won't have the capacity to look at all taxpayers, and a recognition that right now when they do audits, they primarily look at people who itemize because their tax returns are more complicated and they claim more deductions and things like that that need to be more fully examined. And so the idea that a very small number of taxpayers now itemize 15% actually means the IRS has a better way of holding accountable those taxpayers that continue to itemize. By doing this for taxpayers that claim a standard deduction, which now can be as much as, you know, 75 to 85% of taxpayers, there's also an acknowledgement by some policymakers that the IRS is just, they're never going to give the IRS the resources it needs to properly oversee that 85%. So they want us to come back with a suggestion of an alternative way to do that. In part, I think, you know, we as a sector read that as like, well, that's your fault as a policymaker right. for not, you know, fully funding an oversight body. But it's also sort of an acknowledgement of a political reality that they say, if you want to see giving expanded and grow, you need to take this into account. But the other piece that I kind of wonder, I come at this from a fundraiser perspective of when you go out and you ask someone for money, sometimes they give you a reason why they're not going to give, but it's not the real reason. I also question whether or not from policymakers, sometimes the substantiation issue isn't the real reason they're raising it. It may be a nice justification, especially if they want to include something like a floor. They say, oh, well, you need to substantiate it. So maybe a floor could help solve that problem instead of just saying, well, we really want a floor because it controls costs.
We are getting close to 3 o'clock, and so I do want to ask the last question around bipartisan nature of legislation. Is that, as I've said, we've had some folks say to us in no uncertain terms, look, we cannot get our organization behind something that isn't bipartisan. So to what degree is that an issue, a consideration for others on the call?
From Three Forks' perspective, that's no consideration. If it's a good policy, it's a good policy.
Okay. Others? Okay, we are just shy of 3. I'm going to look to my teammates here and see, is there a way that we can, with an email or something to those on the call, give them the opportunity to stew on these questions a little bit more and provide feedback? I want to reiterate, this is our opportunity, right, to provide some framing guidance. We don't always get this opportunity. So we want to make sure that we're giving everybody the opportunity to provide their voice, and then this window will close.
We will send something out when it's not supporting.
Yep. George, is that you?
Yeah, my last conversation with Senator Stabenow was like at the end of February, and we were talking about what she might be willing to do. And at that time, what she reiterated to me is that it was really important for the sector to supply her office with some kind of data, whether it was analytic or it was qualitative, some kind of data about the impact that was being felt from the tax changes.
Right.
But of course, that's not something that people are going to immediately feel in most cases. But she made it really clear to me at that time that they thought they needed that kind of ammunition.
So, George, we continue to hear, from just about every corner, both in the policymaking community as well as the sector, everybody's looking for data. How is giving behavior changing as a result of reform? And
right.
clearly in the conversation that we had with Sarah, she said, look, data is important, but she also recognized that it is going to be some time before we have a sense of, really the new steady state of giving. So
exactly.
She made pretty clear that between now and then, yes, very important to continue to try and piece that picture together. Data, however, we can get our arms around it. We're spending a lot of time here at IS thinking about that. Anecdotes that we can hear from the field. We're thinking a lot about that, but they seem anxious to get something out into the world sooner rather than later. So whatever, their thinking continues to evolve. I think we all know that data will be critical to the debate when the debate happens. And look, let's be very clear. I don't think any of us expects that because Senator Stabenow is introducing something in 2018, that it is in 2018 going to be considered. I think she wants a marker out in the world. And so that is what we're helping her to do. I think we all agree that, this window likely doesn't open until 2019. The next time we can come in and really make a serious policy push around tax code and charitable giving. But she wants something out. She's anxious to put something out in the world in the interim.
Okay, understood.
Okay. We are at 3 or a couple minutes thereafter. We're going to let you go. The next call is on the 26th of April, when we will be joined by a new IS policy team member, Ben Kershaw, known to some of you, if not many of you on the line, will be joining the IS team. You know that Jamie has moved down to North Carolina, and is going to be transitioning off later this spring. We're thrilled to have Ben joining the team, and you'll be hearing more from him certainly on the 26th, if not before. He arrives on the 16th. Thank you very much. We do hope also, Becca, do you want to say something quickly about?
Yes, I can do it very quickly. We just had a few resources that we wanted to remind everyone. We just put out our second edition of the Voices for Good newsletter that accompanies the podcast many of you may be familiar with. If you had some content today that you'd like to share, the newsletter is easily shareable. There's blog posts and articles there. I just want to remind everyone of the Nonprofit Action Network. It's our new Slack community. So if you're hearing things on the Hill or in your meetings or coalitions, that's the place to share it. If you're not a part of that, please let us know and we'll get you added immediately. And then one final request. We're getting further along in the planning for our fall, a late fall event, the Upswell event that we're having this year. So if there's any content or trending topic that you'd like us to discuss, please let me know. My email is rebeccav@independentsector.org. Thank you.
Thanks, Becca. Thank you all. We will talk again on the 26th of April. And you'll be getting an email from us shortly in follow-up to the conversation we just had.
Thank you.